Welcome to Regenerative Spaces, a podcast that explores holistic and sustainable paths toward thriving in the fields of agriculture, education, spirituality, and beyond. Hey there, and welcome to Regenerative Spaces. I'm your host, Stacy Pellice. I'm a regenerative farmer in Santa Barbara, California, but my background and interests span a much broader range of fields, from psychology to spirituality and beyond. In my 3+ decades as an environmental activist, author, and educator, I've gotten increasingly curious about the links between the various ecosystems humans occupy. On this podcast, I'm inviting you to get curious with me. These episodes feature approachable conversations with inspiring experts in different disciplines, from intuitive healers and nonprofit founders to activists and educators. We'll cover county politics, cattle ranching, and a whole world of other specialties in between. These folks are all at the forefront of their chosen fields, and each one offers a unique perspective on holistic, sustainable, and regenerative possibilities for our individual and collective lives. Today, you'll meet Sarah Miller McCune, a personal mentor and visionary leader who has not only transformed the landscape of international academic publishing, she's also been a force for social and cultural development in Santa Barbara. Sarah is the founder and chair emeritus of Sage Publications, where she has pioneered new avenues for academic discourse and revolutionized support for research scholars worldwide. Her work shows a dedication to innovation and community protection that is both transformational and inspiring. With a career marked by prestigious board positions and esteemed awards, Sarah's influence on academia and publishing is unparalleled. Sarah is a passionate advocate for positive change in other realms as well. As co-founder and president of the McCune Foundation, her philanthropic efforts address critical issues along California's Central Coast, mobilizing grassroots organizations to empower local communities in climate change, gender equality, and technology. Join us as we delve into the trailblazing journey of Sarah Miller McCune. Hello, Sarah. So good to see you today. How are you?
I'm as good as I can be, given that I'm not in my home. I was affected by that big rainstorm we had. So yeah. I'm talking to you from a hotel, but a very nice hotel.
Very nice. Well, thank you even more so. And I'm impressed with your adaptability. And thank you for being here. I want to start by just saying how I met you, my first impressions, and what I recall. We may have met before this, but what really made an impression for me was, I think it was in about 2013, you were gathering people to talk about a microgrid system that was being proposed in Montecito, or in Santa Barbara. I could be wrong here, but at any rate, it was around an environmental discussion around renewable energy. I've also met you relative to the sociology department at UCSB. You're very involved at the university around women's issues. And most recently, I was at your home where you hosted Diane Huerta, who at 93 is still a major force and dealing with the feminist majority and women's issues in today's environment.
Well, it's Dolores Huerta, not Diane.
Oh, did I say Diane? There is a Diane, though, isn't there? Yeah. Dolores, that's right. Si se puede. Thank you for correcting me. But at any rate, just to say that my experience of you is as a community advocate and a very involved woman. Only after a certain period did I learn about your history as the creator of Sage Publications. And that blew my mind because I, you know, studied for a PhD. And so as an academic, you have factored large in my life. So that's how I recall meeting you. And what I want you to do for our listeners is maybe answer a question that I like to ask, which is, how would you say you came to be who you are today? Was it an obvious thing? Have you always sort of been this person? Was it a winding road? How might you let us in on how you became, well, as your book title says, being Sage, but being Sarah? Can you give us a little insight into that, your story?
Sure, I'll try. Let's see. I started out as Sarah Joy Miller, and as a teenager, I was very active in a youth organization and wound up being their representative, one of their representatives at the 1960 White House Conference on Children and Youth. And that was when I was in my late teens. And I guess I grew up in a family where people believed I was intelligent, so I was confident about my intelligence and comfortable with it. And people believed that I could do pretty much anything I wanted to do. Probably my mother and my aunts more than my uncles, but my dad believed in me for sure. So when I decided, with the encouragement of one of my mentors in the publishing business, after only 3 years being in the publishing business, to start a publishing company of my own, I felt very confident about it. And the reason the company, which is now known as Sage Publishing because of the transformation from print to digital that is going on and being ramped up more and more each year. Sage was, for me, in biblical times, a sage was a scholar. My late husband at that time, George McCune, was looking for ways to deal with our name. And so he took the SA from Sarah and the G from George and put that on his list. And it was the only name that was on both lists. And so I took that to mean that it had to be Sage. And it has been Sage ever since.
I love that. I haven't known that until recently. It's a great name. So here you are at age 23 at a time when that was a very bold move. Women didn't have, in many ways, as much power as they do now in business. And so it was probably more unusual. Was that true? Was that your experience? It sounds like you always just felt you could do whatever you wanted, regardless of gender.
Well, I felt that I could do what I thought I could do because I was willing to work hard and because I believed I would work smart. Mm-hmm. I knew that I was pushing it, but I had been so discouraged with the two publishing houses that I had worked in previously, and what I thought they were doing in terms of making mistakes, and that I just felt, look, what have I got to lose? A bit of time. But I'm young. I can always make up for that if this doesn't work. but I think I can make it work. So why shouldn't I do it now? And so I did.
Well, that was a brilliant move for all of us, actually. And so was always in the scholarly realms your publishing focus?
Very much so. And in particular, the social and behavioral sciences, because I had switched my major in college from English literature to political science. And I felt that the social and behavioral sciences were not getting the same kind of attention and care as the science and technology. Well, there wasn't so much technology then, but certainly as science and medicine, for example, retreated, or engineering and so on. So, and I didn't feel at that point I wanted to become a humanities publisher or a literature publisher. I wanted to be a social science publisher that took it seriously and would work with the authors to give them the best experience possible as an author at Sage and an author in the mid-1960s.
That seems like a novel, excuse the pun, approach, though, to be inclusive with the authors themselves. And it feels to me, from what I understand, that that move toward working with academics in terms of those who were doing research and how they were wanting to do research, meaning methodology, that feels like a very big move. My experience is that perhaps you had a large contribution to qualitative research methods. Is that true?
Yes, we started out with quantitative research methods.
Oh, you did, okay.
And then we realized, well, in addition to quantitative, the little green book, we also needed to do qualitative. And then ultimately, with the help of our by then British colleagues, we realized that we also needed to pay attention to mixed methods research methodologies.
Right. For those listeners that are not as fond of research, maybe as I am.
Or me.
Or you, right? Well, I'm curious to know if you came up against obstacles in bringing qualitative methodologies and research methods forward. Was that an issue? I mean, was there a time it wasn't considered hard science, or was that actually the attempt to bring non-STEM, we could call it now, non-STEM into a scientific rigor?
I think that from our point of view, we needed to offer both because they were needed for different kinds of research. And if you're trying to be the publisher who is the most advanced in the world in the area of research method for social scientists, then you need to offer all of the methodology so that the social scientists can determine what they need for their research programs. And it's not us telling them, it's them picking out what is needed. And that, of course, did ultimately, within less than two decades, result in us becoming the major publisher in the field of evaluation research and making that hugely available globally.
Right. That's the other thing, is everyone has access. That is so impactful. I mean, there is so much impact, and it's so unusual in terms of a publisher following the actual constituents, you might say, or I don't know what you would say, the customer who is looking to be published, but you're following their lead. I love that.
Yes, but if you don't follow the lead of the smartest people in the fields that you're publishing in, how will you get the best products to sell? I mean, it's important for me that we have advisors like Peter Rossi and James S. Coleman of the Coleman Report, and Pat Moynihan, and Morris Janowitz, and I mean, the list goes on, Donald Campbell, you know, on and on and on. If we did not have their input, we would not have been successful at all.
I'm wondering, like, when did you break through from being this small company to really becoming something bigger? I know you made a move to England kind of early on, unusually.
Yes.
Do you think that was a major piece in becoming a broader entity?
Well, it seemed sensible to us at the time because it meant we were giving up less revenue than if we waited another 10 years. It would be more of an impact on the American business. But in fact, we also recognized that not all of the greatest behavioral and social scientists in the world were based in the United States. So it made sense to have an office in London and reach out not just to the UK, but to Europe. And then each extension, if you will, brought us to other people, whether they were in Africa, South America, Israel, the Middle East, the Far East, Singapore, China. You know, there's good research going on everywhere. And you need to be able to connect with the best.
What an exciting life you've had.
And it didn't hurt that George and I loved to travel.
Yes. Because you have offices all over. I mean, even a couple of years ago, well, before the pandemic, I remember hearing about your schedule, and you were already in your 80s.
By then, we were already well established in Australia, in Singapore, and we even had a subsidiary company in mainland China. We had been a presence in Japan. We were known pretty much throughout the world, certainly by the turn of this century, and to some extent in certain circles before that.
So just if you can, I'm sure you can, tell me how many journals, academic journals, do you have? How many?
We publish, including now even some journals in engineering and medicine, but we publish about 1,400 journals worldwide.
Right. Wow. That's impressive. Now, recently, when we were together at your home, you were telling me about a very significant event that happened with Sage, and I think it also is another big distinguishing feature for the future of Sage. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it had always been a decision of mine and George as well that Sage was not going to become a subsidiary of Elsevier or Pearson or some other giant publisher, because we had seen the devastating effects of various waves in the publishing industry of what we called merger mania. And so we wanted Sage to be an independent company in perpetuity. And in 1989, we developed an estate plan and set it up so that originally the intention was upon my death, Sage Publications would be moved into a trust. But But as it happened, we had a bestseller during the COVID period, and we sold 500,000 books in 4 months.
And what was that title?
And that was the Distance Learning Playbook. And school districts were snapping them up by the hundreds. And yeah. So we wound up with a great deal of money. And the following year, Sage put forward their interest in having the trust created during my lifetime rather than after my death, because they had the money to buy my voting shares. And by then, George had been dead. He died in 1990, but I knew that he would agree with me that, you know, now was the time. And so the company is now in the trust, and I don't have to worry about that getting messed up after my death. It's there. The trust exists. I'm not a part of it. My son and my grandson are minority shareholders, and we have board members who make up the rest of the trust board. And it works very well.
Yeah. That is such a wonderful thing. And it's for the benefit of all, truly. I mean,
I think so.
Sage can't go anywhere. Yeah. We need Sage.
Sage is meant to continue to grow and flourish. Mm-hmm. It's not meant to just stay as what it is. We don't want to be static. We do want to be moving forward, because if you don't continue to grow and change and respond to your authors, as we have always tried to do, then you are in danger, and you're be dangerous to the company. But I think that being in the trust is a great assurance to our senior management, to our middle management, to all of our employees. And it's certainly recharged the board, I think, as well.
It's exciting. Well, it's interesting because you talked about, you know, continuing to be adaptive. And it's what we were talking about a little bit earlier today, is that, you know, you're out of your house, you're in a hotel room, you have to remain adaptive at your age, which is so impressive. And it's how you stay so young at heart, I feel, and so relevant. And we were talking recently, and you were sharing that you had a lot of goals, but that your goals kind of cut off at a certain age because you just didn't imagine going beyond it. And now you've gone beyond it. And so talking about unexpected longevity, we were sitting with, again, Dolores Huerta, who is, I believe, 93. But I thought that was so interesting. You having lived this very long life and then continuing and not having expected it.
Well, that was because I had had two cancers, and cancer runs in my dad's family. Mm-hmm. And I sort of assumed incorrectly, as it turned out, that, you know, by the time I was 78 or so, I'd die because I'd had these bad cancers. I might have another cancer, whatever. And then all of a sudden, I was turning 80, and I hadn't expected that. But again, you have to be adaptive. It's not like I want to go out and commit suicide. So I just figured, well, okay, let's see what happens.
So do you feel like you've become less goal-directed and you're more a let's-see-what-happens person?
I've always been open to seeing what's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's been one of the ways in which we have grown Sage. Mm. And it's been one of the ways in which my own life has grown. So, for example, now I'm working on a climate resilience policy with a gentleman at the University of California, San Diego, who is known around the world as the Pope's climate scientist. And I'm helping him because I can. I have a bit of time, a certain amount of contacts, and a certain amount of money. And it seemed to me like a good thing to do.
That's the thing, is I'm aware there's the McCune Foundation. And I'm wondering, some of the things that I have known you through, which is this climate work or feminism work or other kinds of community, is that your philanthropic arm? Is that just your personal? I'm sure it's both, but I kind of want to hear about that, because what a great example you are of someone who, through a lot of hard work, intelligence, and making good decisions at the right time, you've been very successful. And I see you really turning that toward your community and making a difference.
Yes, but the McCune Foundation, we realized quite a long time ago, needed to be fairly small and directed to two counties here in California, the one where I live and the one where I work. So Ventura, where Sage is located, and Santa Barbara, where I live. And those two counties have their own problems. And the McCune Foundation is looking at the problems, particularly that affect the poor and the underserved in these two counties, in order to enable those people to better their lives on their own with training in things like advocacy and organizing skills, as well as the leadership skills to do that kind of work effectively.
Wow, okay.
And we're doing that in collaboration with a few other foundations in the area. Mm-hmm. And our board members are very excited about this blossoming of our activities.
Well, God knows. I mean, as much as we have here in this community, we have so many challenges. We have
poverty.
I know.
People don't recognize that.
It's hard to believe. Trafficking, poverty, I mean, all kinds of. If you look at the statistics, it's a little daunting. But I know you're doing your part. And what I feel is that I see you as a powerful woman. There's no way around that. You are a powerful woman. But I also see you being on behalf of women. And the gathering we were at was really looking at the feminist majority's fight and the Equal Rights Amendment and where that whole process is at. And you, I was sitting next to you, and you gave such an impassioned, I want to call it a speech. It wasn't really a speech, but it was just you expressing how important this moment is. And I was like, wow, I would love to hear you say a few things about, having lived this long, having done so much, what do we need to do to help women struggle for equality, no matter who you are, no matter what gender you are? But where are we at, Sarah? You seem so well-informed and so passionate and clear.
Well, I don't know that I'm the best informed person right now, but I do know that I'm very passionate about equal rights. And that's true for women. That's also true for minorities. in this community, it should also be true for the indigenous. Mm. We're not very good when it comes to what's going on with the seven Chumash tribes that do not operate a casino and who have lots of problems of their own. So, I mean, everywhere you look, you can see inequality. When I look at the Equal Rights Amendment in the United States, and I see that we actually reached the number of states that was necessary to get that passed, and a few politicians sort of stopped it in its tracks, I get very, very angry. Mm-hmm. And I feel that that is one of the most blatant errors that politicians in Washington have committed in the last few decades. And believe me, they've committed a lot of blatant errors. It's not mm-hmm. just this one. But mm-hmm. to take half the population and say, you are unequal to men, when it's not true, seems to me to be ludicrous and mean-spirited and also pretty dumb.
That's right.
Because you're not getting the best out of half the population.
Right.
It's
you're
crazy.
Cutting off your nose to spite your face.
And a lot
because
more.
You can.
Because you're also doing a lot of damage to other people in the United States who are poor and underserved.
Well, it seems like not being protected under the U.S. Constitution as an having equal rights as a human being, you know, as a woman, and the fact that if we were to take a poll, let's call it a quantitative poll, and you know, let's do that research and find out how many people actually believe women should be considered equal under the Constitution. I mean, the numbers are very high. It's like in the 80s, 85%.
It's quite high. Yes.
Right.
I don't know 85. The exact number, but
yeah,
it's quite
it was something
high.
Like that.
It's well over 2/3, well right. over 2/3 of right. the population. And it's right. bizarre.
Well, is that one of your efforts here at this point in your life? Is that one of the key passions for you?
I certainly will continue to work on that, but right now I've got some other issues on the fire, so to speak, mm-hmm. including the Climate Resilience Project that I mentioned.
Right.
And I can only do so much at any given point in time.
And you seem to always be very hands-on. You've been engaged.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Now that I'm getting older, I really do believe that there are plenty of wonderful young people, whether they're working for me or whether they're people I meet or people I interact with, who are doing great things. And I want to encourage them to continue to do more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a part of what we need to do as well.
Empowering
yes.
the younger generation.
Very much so.
Well, that's hopeful because I feel like when you put your mind to something, things happen.
Well, a lot of people have to put their minds to something
yes.
for things to really change.
Right.
And I hope that this conversation will bring a few other people to the forefront, but we'll see.
Well, you know, the microgrid that was so hard to get people convinced, they started with Santa Barbara, then after the debris flow, it went to Montecito, and could we at least get a microgrid for our fire department, the water department, and Montecito Union? That didn't get liftoff, but what I'm hearing now from Craig Lewis is that actually, I mean, they're at the schools putting solar panels in the parking lots, and it's really sort of getting some movement. Yes. So it takes a while sometimes.
It does. And I recognize that. I've seen that happen. It's okay, as long as it does eventually get done.
Right. We're going the
I'd
right
like
direction.
I'd like it to be the sooner rather than the better, but you don't always get what you want right away.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you have such a nice broad perspective on life, so you've learned a few things. So your wisdom is well taken, is what I would say for those of us, you know. What would you say was the best chapter of your life? Like, what are some of the chapters that are you're the most fondly recalling?
Oh, wow.
Because you've had such a rich, interesting life. I'm just kind of curious. I won't hold you to it, but I'm just kind of curious.
Well, I can remember being very happy about the Peace Corps getting through. That was one of the things we recommended. Yeah, I mean, we didn't call it that at that time, but it was one of the recommendations from the White House Conference on Children and Youth. I'm glad, very glad that I started SAGE. I'm very glad that SAGE, I mean, certainly our 50th anniversary year when we had celebrations in Washington, here in Santa Barbara, New York, London, New Delhi, those celebrations were huge for me. And even the thought that next year will be our 60th year is, you know, a delight to know that it's coming along and we're making plans for small parties in various parts of the world so that our employees can celebrate with us. Just that these last 10 years, which have been very good ones for us in terms of growth, in terms of all sorts of things. I just seeing, I can also say that I've been lucky enough to see some of the people that I hired and who I thought had real potential become the president and CEO of the American company, the managing director of the British company, that, you know, that people that I've worked with have continued to flower and grow and take on so much more responsibility. It's amazing and it's wonderful.
What a blessing. You know, reading about, you're very detailed in what you describe of all the people and the processes and the actions taken. And it gives it kind of like a family feeling. I mean, for being such a large, productive entity, it seems to have a family feeling to it. And I think about you and George. I did not know George. I didn't have the pleasure of ever knowing him. But it seems that the two of you as a couple really kind of held that balance. Is that so? Like, you were very much a partner of his, or he was a partner of yours. Oh, I don't know which.
We were each other's partners. And I think we rubbed off each other a bit. And, you know, I got some good things from him and he got a few good things from me. And that's always a blessing.
It is, yes.
And you know that.
I do, yeah, because Ron and I have different qualities, and yet I learn. And we do. A great partnership is like that. But I keep feeling, though, that what a great example that goes back to a time where some women didn't feel they had the same options of the roles they played. And you really were a bit of a trailblazer, it seems to me. I guess you didn't know any better.
No, that's not true. I knew that I was doing things that were not expected of a woman my age. And I just said, well, that's your problem. It's not mine.
And you had that support of a father early on and strong women and then a
strong
husband.
Strong men. And, you know, male colleagues, female colleagues, we are a group of people with a great passion for what we do. Mm-hmm. People like working at Sage. Mm-hmm. They really like it. And mm-hmm. and we're a very unusual publisher. I mean, George came up with an idea that, you know, too many Americans don't ever get a passport and go abroad. Why don't we send anybody who's been with us for 10 years, get them a passport and send them to England to see what it's like being a publisher in England and meet their counterpart in London. And then if they want to see more of Europe, they take their 2 weeks vacation and we pay for them, you know, airfare, and that's their vacation for their 10th year anniversary. And for their 20th year, if they want to go to India or Singapore, they go there, you know. And that kind of thing is just something that George dreamed up that turned out to be a wonderful perk for so many of our employees over the years. And really made a difference to opening their eyes to the rest of the world.
Wow, that is so brilliant. And that level of value you placed in the people that you worked with, I mean, that has to have made an impact on the kind of company that you were. And it's just very unusual in today's business climate. I would not think that would be very common, the way you all saw things.
Yeah. We're having a board retreat this summer up in about an hour and a half away from Montreal. And someone from Patagonia is coming up to be one of the speakers at that board retreat, because Patagonia is a similar company in the sense of also being in a trust like that. And we want our board to understand why we did what we did, how others have done it, and what can be done.
I was speaking to Yvonne Chouinard about a year or two ago and asked him if he has seen a change and are more companies following that model. And he said, you know, everyone wants to hear from us, but nobody wants to practice it. That's what he finds. And so you're the exception. And I said, well, why not? And he said, shareholder profits, you know, just seem to get in the way. And so it sounds like you've been able to have employees and a board that understands there's something greater going on. There's a higher calling to what you're doing, which is what it's sort of like with Patagonia. There's a higher calling. We're not just selling stuff. Yeah. And publishing seems like such a wild industry. And I'm not, you know, the way I see it now, it seems like it has been over the decades here, but you guys have managed to keep that steady ship and do really valuable work. So what an example. Well, so, all right. What would you say, if you had a magic wand, would you want to see in this next chapter of your life? How would you like to see things unfold? What would you like to see change? you know, within your immediate projects, how would you like to have impact? If you had, I mean, the magic wand's important.
Well, I'd certainly want the magic wand to help us get a better handle on climate change and what we can do to combat it and, you know, improve the resilience of the climate for us globally. But I do think I would love to see the Equal Rights Amendment cleared and become a part of our Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like to see much better education for everyone on the planet than there is now. I believe that education is critical to making a better future for people everywhere.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. In terms of climate, those are beautiful and noble goals. And I think when Sarah's mind is put to it, we have hope, is what I think. But do you think people lack information? Or I know for a while there I was doing climate work with the psychological and emotional barriers, as a psychologist, psychological and emotional barriers to engaging climate change. So through fear or through grief, through anger, people were not able to fully engage with the issues right in front of us. Is it an information thing? Is it an emotional thing? Do we just, you know, how can we, if we want to be on Sarah's campaign, be part of Team Sarah, what can we do? I mean, how would you advise us to help move the needle with that?
I can't say that I could give you an answer about that off the top of my head. I'd need to think about it. I need to talk to other people. I'm not an expert in this field. And this is a very, very complex set of problems which are going to need multiple answers from multiple people. The most important thing is that people are waking up to the fact that it is a reality. They're no longer brushing it off the way they used to. They can't afford to, looking at last year and this year, what's been going on.
Right.
But we've got plenty of problems like that, and they're not being well addressed, as you know.
I do. I know. You and I have a lot of similar interests, I think. That's how I've been fortunate. You and I keep running into each other because we share some of the same interests in our community. And that's also, I think, of real interest as an example, is that you're global, but you're also very much engaged in your local community.
I think we have to be both.
I think so too, yeah. But I think you're a great example there. Well, I just want to say thank you for joining us today and giving us a little window into Sarah Miller McCune. You are such, I mean, really for me, an icon and a mentor and a guide and a friend. So thank you for sharing.
You are so welcome. Thank you for asking me to share.
Of course, yeah. And I'll see you at the Women's Giving List.
Okay.
Okay. Take care.
Bye. Mwah.
That's a wrap for today's episode of Regenerative Spaces. If you found this episode valuable or thought-provoking, share it with a friend and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'll keep the conversation going over on Instagram. So join me at Stacy Pollice and share your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future episodes. I love hearing from you. And before we go, your support means the world to me. If you have a moment, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help us reach even more people looking to spark sustainable change in our world. Stay curious, stay inspired, and until next time, this is Stacy Pollice, and you've been listening to Regenerative Spaces.